The majority of Floridians can now get their COVID vaccine starting today. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Anyone 16 or over is now eligible, and it's all happening as Florida has already vaccinated millions. We'll take a look at how the efforts shift starting today. Also, the state has a new law in the books that makes it very difficult to sue a company, hospital, or nursing home if you think they were negligent and allowed COVID to spread. Finally.
So I don't regret not being a lawyer. I do feel that I was meant to do this.
We'll meet Teresa Murphy, Miami-Dade's Teacher of the Year, who embraced teaching from home, all while battling cancer. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. All of that today on the show. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. 3 million Americans are getting COVID vaccines a day, increasing hopes for us all to return to some sense of normalcy by the summer. Florida has opened vaccine eligibility to those 16 and older starting today. More than 6.5 million have already received their first dose, according to the Florida Department of Health, like Brooke Whitley in Miami.
My feelings going into that first appointment were just great relief. I mean, of course, I was a little bit nervous, but I hadn't heard any bad things about first shot side effects, so I just was happy to get it. Being vaccinated means so much to me. I have a 16-month-old son. He was 3 months old when this all started. Because of it, he hasn't met that many people. We haven't been able to travel. I mean, nothing about his first year was what we planned, and getting the vaccine was really sort of what I saw as the beginning of the end.
However, many are still struggling to book appointments or have faced problems for not having health insurance. Joining us now is WLRN's healthcare reporter, Veronica Zaragovia. Veronica, always great to have you.
Thank you so much, Louis.
So remind us of, you know, how we got to this point. Just a few weeks ago, we were still vaccinating people over 55. Now it's everybody, 16 and over. What changed so quickly?
Well, first, Orange County Mayor Jerry Demings had announced that the age would drop to 40 for a COVID-19 vaccine on March 22nd. And then Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava followed with in Miami-Dade County for March 29th. And that might have led Governor Ron DeSantis to drop the minimum ages in Florida. He has indicated that Florida would have opened up before the May 1st deadline set by President Joe Biden. So that takes us to today, where if you're 16 or 17, you're eligible only for the Pfizer vaccine with a guardian present or parent, of course, and everybody else 18 and older.
Is there, for young people, I mean, like talking about teenagers, is there a vaccine that's being pushed more for them than everybody else?
Really, the only difference is that Pfizer vaccines have been approved officially for people 16 and older. Otherwise, you know, the more the messages get, whatever is available at a site. And only today can parents take a 16 or 17 year old to a Miami-Dade college, because this is the last day that they offer the first dose Pfizer vaccine. Other than that, then a parent or guardian will need to make an appointment, let's say at a state site like Hard Rock Stadium or Marlins Park, and then take a 16 or 17-year-old there.
Yeah. So Florida, my understanding is, has gotten hundreds of thousands of new vaccines this week. What are you hearing from residents? Has the experience of getting that appointment or getting that shot, that first shot, gotten easier? I mean, what has the rollout been getting better?
Well, I think it's still a bit confusing because there's so many pop-up sites that are opening up every day. And unfortunately, that leaves out a lot of people who don't use Twitter. But if you're open for the two-dose mRNA vaccines, then in my experience, you can find quite a lot of appointments via CVS or Walgreens or Walmart. Many of the pharmacies, Publix has some specific dates, but CVS, for example, if you try at midnight, you will likely find an appointment available. The problem is always with supply and demand. We didn't get that many Johnson & Johnson vaccines in the last week or two, so tons of people reach out to me to find out, where can I get that one? And that one will be available, 3,000 a day at Miami-Dade College North Campus starting tomorrow, Tuesday. And I think that will help people at least, you know they can just walk up or drive up. And if, you know, you'll have to wait because there are a lot more people now, but that will help.
Yeah. We're hearing from a lot of folks throughout South Florida. We heard from Veronica in Miami Shores. Here's some about her experience getting a shot.
It was interesting to see in the line people from, you know, different backgrounds and different age groups. And the moment I took the vaccine, I asked the person that was putting the vaccine if I could take a selfie, and she was fine. So for me, it was like a very happy moment. And a very proud moment.
Yeah. You know, Veronica, are places like CVS, Walgreens, Publix, are they requiring individuals to show health insurance?
So here's the thing. These pharmacies and doctor's offices and some hospitals, they get reimbursed. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is offering $40 to administer each dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. So that's why they ask for insurance, because then they would get reimbursed through that health insurance company. There is an option to say you're uninsured when you make the appointment, and then it's up to that administrator to get reimbursed from the federal government. And so they cannot turn you, so, you know, say there's no vaccine for you because you're uninsured. You also cannot be charged by federal rules for a vaccine. So if they're asking for the insurance, it's to bill the insurance company.
Mm. And I'm wondering, too, when it comes to, you know, showing some form of ID, is that, you know, pretty much anywhere you go, you have to show that?
Well, they do ask for, yeah, they will ask for, you know, sometimes people will go and tell me they didn't get asked for that. But according to state rules, you do need to prove Florida residency. So that would be an ID, like a driver's license or another kind of Florida identification, or proof of residency would be like a lease or a property deed. And I do want to say quickly that when I made my own appointment at CVS, the system did ask for my insurance information. So you should have that handy. At one point, the whole system crashed. I mean, it's just something I did want listeners to know. They should have that with them.
Again, talking with WLRN healthcare reporter Veronica Zaragovia. Vaccinations are open to Floridians 16 and up beginning today. You can find more information about where to sign up, all the different locations. It's on our website at WLRN.org. By the way, just to mention, I actually used our website to try to figure out where to go get my first shot, and I ended up going to the North Miami-Dade College campus because it didn't require registration. Got my first shot there on Friday. There is a line, there is a wait, but everybody was really helpful, and it went pretty quickly. So, it wasn't that big of a deal. Veronica, there are pop-up vaccine sites showing up around a lot of communities, right? But not always announced, right? Not always announced publicly.
Right. And by the way, Louis, I'm very happy for you that you've gotten your vaccine.
halfway there.
Yeah, halfway. There are, that, you know, they don't always announce them, although they're on the Florida Division of Emergency Management's website. And I'm going to start adding those to our webpage that we have on WLRN.org, where we have the sites where you can get a vaccine. So any pop-up sites that I know of, I'll add them, but they run out so early. And I think the goal is that they don't want a flood of people who are not from low income communities to get in front of the line, because a lot of these sites are meant to help communities that have been underserved. And so I think that's why they don't publicize it as much. But I had a listener tell me that they went to one of these pop-ups and it ran out by 9:30. They were out. So that's one thing to keep in mind, that if you don't go really early, that will be a problem. And another listener reached out and said, well, what if, you know, vaccines are left over because they're not announcing these? So, you know, I don't know. I try to share as much as I can. But yeah, some of these just are a little harder to find.
Yeah. Now, just to mention, Governor DeSantis last week has passed an executive order preventing so-called vaccine passports You know, allowing access to folks who've gotten inoculated to anything, mostly events, travel, et cetera. But do we know whether or not that's going to be challenged? Has anybody said anything about that?
I haven't heard about challenges, but it could certainly happen because there's not been any kind of explanation, whether at the local level, whether, say, counties could ask for them. All of that is a bit unclear for right now. And the governor has said that that would reduce people's individual freedoms and patient privacy. But that it's on the business side, it's a way to encourage people to get their vaccine so that then they can participate in, you know, events that might have more people there.
Have you heard from any public health experts about that idea, the idea of a vaccine passport?
Well, a lot of times people point to countries that have really high vaccination rates, like let's say Israel, where they do that. They you know, you kind of show that you've been vaccinated and then you can be part of an event. And so I think public health experts might say it could help. I even had a source today that I've been trying to, she's dealing with her parents who have hesitancy towards the vaccines. And she said, well, maybe if that will help my mom travel, then that'll motivate her to get the vaccine. So I think it might end up, you know, being something that will, that public health experts might say might be a good idea. But of course, the privacy concerns are there as well.
Yeah. The other thing too that I saw was there might be a concern with fake vaccine cards, you know, because when you get your vaccine, you get a little card that shows what you got, how you got your one shot or your two shots, depending on what it was. But is this a big problem the state's worried about?
Yeah, well, the state's attorney general joined a lot of other states, not the majority of them, in a letter that was sent to the CEOs of Shopify, Twitter, and eBay, where it seems people are finding these fake CDC cards, to monitor that they, to ask them to monitor ads for these fake cards and also ask them to take information of anyone selling them. And because the problem is when you post it on social media, and there, you know, that's where they can find certain information and then use it to sell the fake CDC card. So be careful of that, of blurring that part out. You know, people are proud, and it's the one, I would say, collective experience that brings us joy and hope, you know, to show, hey, I got my card, I'm vaccinated. And so, you know, not to take that away from anyone, but just blur those, that private information off. That's what they're asking people to do.
Listen, I took a picture of the blue Band-Aid. That was,
I got, that's here's safer. My shot.
That's as much as I'm going to show you. I'm not showing you anything else. Real quickly to finish up is there have been reports of folks dealing with side effects from the vaccine, particularly the second dose. What have health experts said? Is this normal? Should we be concerned?
Absolutely normal, not to be concerned. It's your immune system that's kicking into gear, and it shows that the vaccine is working, which is what we want. Unfortunately, that means some people might not feel well enough to go to work, and of course, I sympathize greatly with that. But it will just be pretty much, if anything, a 24-hour period, and it's very individual from person to person. I know some people have felt a little ill that after the second shot, some haven't felt anything. I think it's something that with an over-the-counter fever reducer, you'll be fine. So it's nothing to panic about from, you know, what medical experts say.
And as always, if you feel something, just go talk to your doctor and let them know.
Yeah.
Again, been talking with WLRN healthcare reporter Veronica Zaragovia. Find all of her reporting on this on our social media at WLRN Sundial, also on the website WLRN.org. And that's where you can find all the information about where to get tested or where to get vaccines, how to register. All of it is right there for you. Veronica, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Louis.
And by the way, you can share your vaccine story with us. Have you been able to get it easily, or has it been kind of a challenge? Anna in Miami reached out to us.
So when I got there and the nurse was asking me, are you nervous? I was like, no, I'm actually very excited to get it. I believe in science, and I feel like this is a great opportunity for us to do our part. And I feel that I'm doing my part getting my shot to help in this pandemic.
And we want to hear from you, your thoughts of getting your vaccine. And by the way, maybe you don't want to get the vaccine. I've been running into people who just tell me, I'm not going to do it. That's fine. Tell us why. Tell us why or why not. Find us on the Sundial Text Club. It's a new thing. You can join us. Just text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's just type the word hello to 786-677-0767, our Sundial Text Club. It's a great way to stay in touch with you. You can always tell us your thoughts about anything you hear on the show, and maybe you'll be part of a future program. Well, still to come, if you lost a loved one to COVID in a nursing home or a hospital, can you take legal action against the institution? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. 33,674. That's the number of people who've lost their lives to COVID-19 in Florida. Thousands more family members are continuing to grieve and struggle with the repercussions of losing their loved ones. For many, it remains unclear whether the hospitals, nursing homes, or grocery stores where they were working or being treated could have done more to protect them. Under a new law passed by Governor Ron DeSantis, it'll be very difficult for these businesses to be held criminally liable. Michael Ryan is an attorney with the consumer justice law firm Friedland Harwin Valori Ryan. He's also the mayor of Sunrise in Broward County, and he joins us now. Michael, thanks so much for the time.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this story.
Based on your understanding of this law, under what circumstances could someone bring a lawsuit against, say, a hospital or nursing home if their loved one had become sick or worse, had passed away from COVID-19 while in the care of that institution?
Yeah, this is a law that's very broad and complex, but fundamentally, there are going to be thousands of families who are going to be denied the opportunity to hold anyone accountable for the wrongs committed against their family members. The new law is very strict in what types of cases can be brought, and the standard that a family will have to prove is extraordinarily high and difficult.
Yeah, what does that process look like? I mean, if I wanted to bring one of these institutions to court, where do I even begin?
So the law breaks it into two different areas, and this is an incredibly important point. We have seen reporting in workplaces of all sorts of failures to protect, whether it's in the agricultural area or meatpacking plants. So for lawsuits in which a business is being sued, not a healthcare provider, fundamentally, what you have to show is right when you file your initial complaint are all the details, and you have to have an affidavit of a physician. And the court gets to decide, not a jury, whether you've done your job at the initial proof level. And if you don't prove that the defendant failed to make a good faith effort to protect, the court can throw your lawsuit out. So it's changed the burden that a plaintiff has to bring, a person who's been injured. And even if you get by all of that, then you have to prove the business was grossly negligent, essentially the punitive damage standard, in order to get any semblance of justice.
My understanding is the law doesn't protect against lawsuits that have already been filed, right?
So it does not protect against those. There is some retroactive components of this. And I think that there are a number of constitutional challenges I think we'll see from this. And we should always be fearful when we see such a broad intrusion on constitutional rights in a time of crisis and panic. At the end of the day, this is really a cure looking for a disease, because there have not been a flood of COVID injury lawsuits. There have not been a flood of frivolous lawsuits. If anything, the lawsuits that have been filed related to COVID are really consumer rights, trying to get their refunds. There have been cruise lines. Certainly insurance litigation has been very big. Employees who've been terminated, stockholders. So we just haven't seen a flood of people claiming injuries and trying to hold businesses responsible.
And that's interesting. You brought up cruises, and I wondered, is it just Florida businesses? Because cruises tend to have their offices in another country.
That's true. And I think what any lawsuit that's filed in a Florida state court will have to comply with this new law. Many times, these cases are brought in federal court. So there is some debate about whether or not that will apply depending on the types of actions being brought. But again, there's all, and I've looked at the data, there's only a handful of cases around the state that are claiming a business or a healthcare provider did something wrong regarding COVID that led to somebody's death.
And do you have any clients that have filed suits, or do you expect to have any?
We don't. I've looked at cases. We've looked at a number of cases. These were difficult enough to begin with. And, you know, COVID was a difficult virus. Trying to prove that somebody failed to use reasonable care to protect is a challenge in and of itself. So we just haven't been able to identify a case that we felt comfortable bringing. But there are certainly cases out there.
And I'm wondering, you know, as mayor of Sunrise, you know, if you've heard from any of your constituents about, you know, who've lost a loved one to COVID and their concerns about, well, maybe I think that, you know, that nursing home they were in or the hospital, whatever, may have done something wrong. I mean, has anybody come to you and said anything like that, shared a story like that?
They haven't, but in the days and months and years to come, there are going to be families who are going to be struggling with trying to hold somebody accountable, finding out who is responsible. And this new law is going to make it impossible for those families to have the closure that we expect from the civil justice system.
You know, coming back to your other job as an attorney, what's the process of proving negligence on the behalf of a healthcare provider? How do you even go about doing that?
That's a great question, because even under normal circumstances, you know, trying to prove the failure to use reasonable care means you are really measuring the conduct against what would somebody normally do, a reasonable and prudent person. And that can be a challenge under normal circumstances. Under this new law, you have to prove that they were grossly negligent, almost intentional. And if they prove any of their defenses, they're immune from the litigation. So the other component that's really very difficult about this law is that if the defendant or the target or the one responsible says, I substantially complied with any government standard, they will be immune. And this is revolutionary in a sense, because that type of standard changes it from what a reasonable, prudent person would do to what they did and complied with any standard whatsoever.
I have to imagine, and this is me not knowing, but just that, you know, trying to seek charges against or to sue, you know, a company like a restaurant or a supermarket where you have customers, and maybe that one customer isn't practicing social distancing or wasn't wearing their mask or wasn't doing it properly, but, you know, going after the company and saying you needed to enforce that. I'd imagine even before this law, that would have been difficult to do.
That's exactly correct. And that's why you haven't seen a flood of cases, and where someone, you know, got it is difficult. But what we've seen reported here and across the nation are big companies, whether in the agriculture world or in meatpacking, who really played, you know, Russian roulette with the lives of their workers. And the suggestion that they should never be held accountable and responsible for it is a problem. And AARP came out against this law and noted that over 9,000 have died in nursing homes, and those families are entitled to get some answers, and they won't with this new law.
I think about early on when this pandemic started, it took a while for companies to start to catch up and practice social distancing and masks and so forth. And, you know, for example, I think about like a supermarket, and we'd heard from workers at supermarkets, and some of them had told us, yeah, the company's not really doing a whole lot. And then eventually the company caught up because everybody was. But I mean, at that point, can somebody right now say, look, I was working at this store, or my family member was, they got COVID, they died, because they didn't change the rules fast enough? But even though that was more than a year ago now.
Yeah, I think it's going to be hard. There's a statute of limitations as well on this that shortens the time that a case can be brought. And as you point out, in the early days, it certainly there wasn't a lot of clarity, and there was a lot of confusion and even contradictory messages. So already in those early stages, it would have been difficult. But there came a point in time when we knew that certain mitigation strategies needed to be employed, whether imposed by local government or the state. But there were certainly recommendations out there. And you know, trying to prove under this new law that somebody was too slow to do that and it cost lives is going to be extraordinarily difficult.
I'm talking with Michael Ryan, attorney with the consumer justice law firm Friedland, Harwind, Valori & Ryan. He's also the mayor of Sunrise in Broward County. Again, we mentioned Governor Ron DeSantis recently signed into law COVID liability bill, making the process for filing a lawsuit against businesses and or healthcare providers a lot more difficult. You could read more about the law on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Michael, you're coming at this from two perspectives. One, an attorney. And two, as the mayor of a city in South Florida, is there a difference in how you're approaching this from those two different, you know, positions that you have?
No, not really, because from the outset, in my role as mayor, what I wanted to do was protect our workforce, our residents, and our businesses. And we messaged early what needed to be done. And if businesses did what they were supposed to, and it didn't cause injuries, then we're incredibly proud of them. But any business that failed to do what it should have to protect the workforce or its patrons should be held responsible. That's what we expect as a society under due process and equal protection and access to the courts. So it's not inconsistent. It is a matter of making sure we're protecting everyone.
Have you heard any stories from businesses, especially in Sunrise, about this?
No, and I think that's the a really good question, because this law came pretty much out of nowhere. There wasn't a groundswell of concern that I was hearing from businesses that they were going to get sued. You know, as a lawyer for over 25 years, saw very few cases even being thought about. But when the Senate committee looked at this and said there were, you know, approximately 600 lawsuits, what they didn't say is that the vast majority, 95% of those lawsuits were, again, consumer lawsuits, evictions, wrongful termination, civil rights cases. None of this was really necessary, in my opinion.
So Florida has reportedly one of the strictest COVID liability laws now in the books. Have you been hearing from attorneys in other states about how the process differs for them than us? Is ours really the strictest or one of the worst?
It is one of the strictest. There are 17 states that have different laws, and I think everyone's trying to digest them. Many of these were passed in a rush, but this is probably one of the most onerous.
You know, considering that this pandemic, I mean, we haven't been through anything like this in 100 years, so it's a very new phenomenon for all of us. Is there a concern about legal precedent setting the course for future cases? Like, someone files a lawsuit against a nursing home, is unsuccessful, and so now all future cases are determined based on the outcome of that one.
Yeah, there's a real concern. And as I started, I think we should be fearful whenever our legislature passes something so intrusive on our constitutional rights to the courts in a time of crisis and panic. The unintended consequences of this law are still not fully understood. And I fear that this will get by this particular area, right, this COVID issue. But they'll use this, I fear, as a template to continue to deny rights to those who are trying to hold others responsible for bad behavior. And that's the biggest fear.
So coming back again, if there is someone who believes there is negligence or that some business or healthcare provider should be held accountable, what's the how do you start that process? And again, because you touched on it a little while ago, and I want to remind people of what you need to have, because the burden of proof is going to be on you. And it's very difficult now.
It is. And the first thing I would say is that people need to go consult with a lawyer if they're concerned about trying to hold someone accountable. And they need to do it quickly. The statute has, you know, the new law has a 1-year statute of limitations. Even to get through the investigation, you have to be able to plead your complaint with a very high level of specificity as to what you think happened wrong. And then you have to have an affidavit from a Florida physician saying that the injuries or the death were caused by the conduct and by COVID. And then after that, you've got to really prove that they were grossly negligent if it's a business situation. And that's going to be very hard. And it's hard to put that evidence together quickly. So you have got to get started right away. It's a bit of a foot race for those who really want to hold someone responsible to get accountability. And if they wait too long, their rights will be gone forever.
The other thing that's so strange about this this phenomenon of this pandemic is that, you know, there are a lot of people who they're about to experience, you know, a lot of pain and struggle, you know, moving forward. You're working at a consumer justice law firm. And, you know, what I'm talking about is these consumers who are going to be facing in the coming months, everything from evictions to job loss. Are you preparing for a potential deluge of cases?
Well, what I would say is, I think, let me put my mayor hat on first. I think we're all terrified of the wave of evictions and pain that's still to come in our community. As a lawyer, I worry as well for not only those families who've lost a loved one, but as you know, there's been more and more reporting on people who are called long haulers, people who have long-term residual problems from COVID. And if you are unable to seek justice and hold someone responsible and make them pay for that injury, then what we've done is just shifted all of that responsibility to the taxpayers and to the health insurance system, rather than what we believe in America is you're supposed to hold those accountable who've done wrong and not be able to create externalities, if you will, and push that off on others. So, you know, I think we're going to see more and more as we understand the long-term problems of COVID. But I think with this new law, it's going to be very difficult for lawyers to be able to bring these cases. And that was the plan.
Michael Ryan, again, attorney with a consumer justice law firm, Friedland Harwin Valori Ryan. He's also the mayor of Sunrise. Michael, thanks so much for helping us try to understand this new law that just, again, popped up very quickly. It's already on the books. And again, if you want to learn more about it, you can find it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Michael, I appreciate the insight.
Thank you, and good luck with your second shot.
All right, thank you so much. All right, still to come, we're going to meet Miami-Dade's Teacher of the Year, who was fighting cancer while helping her students. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The past year has seen a large impact on education. When the pandemic hit, all classes had to go virtual. Teachers had to reconfigure entire lesson plans overnight. They had to go above and beyond to make sure that their students got the best education possible during these tough times. One of those teachers is Teresa Murphy. She was named Miami-Dade County Public School Teacher of the Year. And we spoke with her about what it was like to face that challenge of not only teaching during a pandemic, but also being treated for breast cancer at the same time. I got to ask you this. I want to start with this. I got to know, why'd you get into teaching?
Well, it just happened that I got into teaching. So I originally was going to use teaching as a means, a temporary means, to pay my way through law school. And I had a professor at Miami-Dade who made a profound impact on me. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, well, first of all, what kind of law did you want to study? And just wondering, do you ever think, what if?
Lots of people tell me that I'd still be very good at it. You know, I don't regret not going into law at all. I was interested in it because when I was in high school, I was in a work study program. I had decided that I was going to graduate early, and I went into work study to get some extra credits, and I went to day school and night school. I actually wanted to graduate a year early and walk in the place of my brother who was killed in an automobile accident a couple of years before, and had made a decision that it was a rocky road after that in school for a few months, as you can imagine, and I decided that it was time to set a goal. And through that goal, I had an administrator, Mr. Manzelli at Palmetto, who said, whatever you need signed in order to do it. And I thought, why in the world is he believing in me? I haven't shown a great track record, because we all go through these different changes and challenges in school. Even the best students can have the worst days. And having, you know, an administrator at the time or a teacher like I did at Miami-Dade really, really made the difference. So I don't regret not being a lawyer. I think it would have been cool, yes. I don't even know what kind of law I would go into. I was doing collections at the time. But I do feel that I was meant to do this.
You know, like everybody, obviously, I mean, last year when the pandemic hit, life changed for everybody. And I'm just wondering for you, what was the quick pivot? What would happen in that moment? And what was that like for you? How did you deal with it?
When we first went home, I was kind of excited. I thought, you know, this is new and different. And when you've been teaching for 27 years, new and different is good. You know, a little bit of change, a little, you know, a little excitement to shake things up is a good thing. So I was really excited about it. I had used a lot of the online resources that Dade County Public Schools had already online. I had used them in my classroom as support for students learning when they were absent or an extension for homework. What many people don't realize is Dade County has resources online that many counties across our nation do not have. And so there were a lot of things in place. So I had a good base and I knew that. And then I was like, so what are some of the fun things I can do? And it was a challenge. Like all of the great things that I was doing, I soon realized that maybe those kids that were smiling weren't smiling at me. They were maybe playing something online, because I was kind of like, is anybody home? So I knew through the summer I needed to make adjustments. And had fun doing that as well. Had fun looking into different ideas and different methods to get a little ahead of those kids.
I hate to say it, but they're kids and they're in front of a screen, so they're probably, you know, playing a game. I know I probably would have been. Do you miss though the classroom?
I do. I miss the human interaction. I miss that a lot. It's been very isolating to be at home. You know, you're not with extended family, you're not having friends come in, and when it comes to the students, you're not, you know, engaging and giving them that you know, pat on the back, so to speak. And it has been different. It's been a challenge. I do miss it. You know, I want to go back, but this has been surprisingly fun.
I hear different things from different teachers. It's I think it's a really fascinating thing a conversation to have. For you, you went through a personal challenge this past, you know, year with a medical diagnosis, which added on top of everything else that you're dealing with. Can you tell us a little bit about what was happening?
Sure. The three C's: COVID, cancer, and chemo, I call it. So I was diagnosed in the summer with breast cancer, and it rocked my world. It was a difficult diagnosis, very unexpected. I'm a very healthy individual and try to work on diet and exercise. I was even giving exercise classes to the teachers when we went home in March in order to get them up and going so they weren't still sitting so stagnant in front of the computer. So that was something that I was enjoying. It was difficult. I was officially diagnosed on August 20th. So it was really right before the school year was going to begin. And I had spent all this time in the summer doing some things to prepare for the teaching.
I'm speaking with Miami-Dade County's Teacher of the Year, Teresa Murphy, about how she's overcome the challenges of the pandemic and embraced online learning. Why not take a break? Why didn't you just say, hold on, I gotta heal? Because being a teacher's tough enough as it is. Why not just say, let me take a break and step away so that I can heal myself? I don't know. What was your thought process there?
So I had a couple of thoughts. First and foremost, I really didn't want to miss this opportunity of this online teaching. It was new and different, and I was excited about it. And I had done all these things to prepare, and I thought, okay, let me just hold on a little bit longer. You know, let's see where this goes. Let's see, you know, I mean, maybe I'll take the leave, right? But then I got a class of students, and you're sitting in front of them, and we don't have a desk job. I have said that again and again. You know, when you have a bad day, you can't come into work and sit in your little cubby and just do your own thing and pout because you've had a bad morning. We have to come in and sing and dance and smile and laugh and be positive. That's our responsibility. And during this time, it is a huge responsibility because these families are going through a lot of very difficult times, and we don't know. And we have a glimpse into some of these homes now, and you could see that it's difficult. During the time that I was online, I don't want to say I forgot I had cancer, but sort of did. So I was able to disconnect from my diagnosis and focus on the children and feed off their positivity, and they fed off of mine. And I truly believe it made us all healthier. Now, there were days I took off. I had some extreme chemotherapies that were brutal and impossible for me to work online. I never claimed to work through all of my chemotherapy. I have worked, and I have worked at the hospital at times where I wasn't feeling sick. I just wasn't at home, but I was able to teach. So I did.
Wait, you taught from the hospital?
I did. I turned off the camera, told the kids I was a little sick that day, told the parents I was a little sick. I was going to have the camera off. And I'll tell you what, they're better with that camera off because they can't see your eyes. They do not know if you're looking at them or not. It is better. I have used that strategy since then, even when I'm at home. And they're going to do something as soon as you turn that camera off and you say, Lewis, what are you doing? So, you know, it actually worked out to be a fascinating tool. But I wasn't sick at the time. And one thing that's really hard right now is stability for the students. Internet issues, both on the teacher side and the student side. Parents working. Now my child's in the car while they've got the iPad. So all of those things made it a little bit more necessary for me to keep as much stability if I could.
When did you find out about the Teacher of the Year Award? How?
So on February 4th, actually all the teachers prior, all four of us, we had to record our acceptance speech, which was a little awkward, right? Accepting something you haven't received. Perhaps the most awkward part was me choking up during the taping. And I actually said, this is kind of silly because I haven't received anything and I'm choking up at my own speech, you know? but there was emotion behind it. And I thought, you know, it was like this reality. So we had recorded all of these things, and they did a phenomenal job putting this whole presentation together. And then I watched it online. So they said, you know, you should have a couple of friends come over, you know, social distancing, have some. And I thought, people come over, like, for, you know, I'm not going to win this thing, you know, like how people come over and just be disappointed. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to celebrate because I am the North Region Teacher of the Year. And that in itself, to me, was absolutely amazing. I would have been very satisfied at that level because it is such a great honor. And so I had a few come over and I set up. I've gotten very handy with the computer, so had some friends help me out too, and we got a sound machine and we had the screen and the LCD projector and everything set up outside on the patio. And I couldn't wait to hear which of the other three teachers it was going to be because we've met online and we've talked and, you know, and they're amazing. They're amazing teachers. And I just knew, I was like, you know, and all of a sudden they said Teresa Murphy.
Are you looking forward to get back to the classroom?
So I am looking forward to it. I can tell you that I probably would not have been fortunate enough to work this year had I not had the ADA approval to work from home. And that's because it would have put great strain on my administration to have to cover me instead of shift 5 minutes later to then, you know, work, you know, you can shift your schedule 5 minutes here or there. If you're in a classroom with the students, someone has to physically cover those 5 minutes. And that would have been a big ask on the part of my principal and staff, right? So other staff members are there going to have to pick up the slack, so to speak. And it would not have been a reality. So as ironic as it sounds, this whole pandemic for me worked out in a positive way because I was able to still reach my students working from home.
Let me finish with this, Teresa. I'm curious because thinking about what you said earlier, you were kind of excited about the opportunity to teach online. And, you know, again, I talked to a lot of different teachers and everybody's got a different take on this. But eventually this is going to end. Eventually we're going back to some kind of normal. Maybe there's a new normal. But what do you think is how education changes because of this? We're going back to the classroom, right? But I mean, technology is also here to stay. So I don't know. What do you think is going to be the future classroom?
So that's a great question. And it's something that I talk to my students about all the time. My students have the ability to Google any answer. There are apps out there that they can scan the test question and the answer and the work for them to show me is going to appear. They can find any answer, they can find any test. All day, every day, with every assignment, the kids will ask me, can we use our notebooks? Now, and they know I can't see whether or not, but I always tell them, they know. And you're gonna have some here or there that don't. But for the most part, I keep reminding them, you're gonna go back to the classroom one day. When you're back in the classroom, and your teacher says, here is the test, you cannot use a resource today for this, and you can't, you have to do that online as well. So if I tell you today's a day you can use a resource, use it. If I tell you open up your reading book to answer these questions, do it. Use that resource. I'm giving you the opportunity. But if I tell you the other day we had a vocabulary test, the words are online, they're in their notebooks, they could have looked. Students said to me, Ms. Murphy, can we look at our notebooks? I said, this is a closed book test. If you choose to look at your notebook when you shouldn't, when you go back to the classroom, I fear you're going to have a more difficult time. And then you're going to be frustrated. So you need to make the best choice for you. And as a parent, I did that. I always put the choices in my children's hands. Now, I gave them only reasonable things to choose from. The kids don't know that, but you put that choice in their hands and you would be surprised. So yes, education is going to change. We've embraced technology a little bit more. We've been fearful of it because as teachers, we feel like they need that human. They need, and in the elementary school, I believe they do. But times are changing, jobs are changing. There are jobs that are never going to go back to their physical building. They've seen that this works and it's more economical for them. I see it with my children who are adults. So they need a combination of the technology and we need to constantly teach that literacy, that etiquette online, but we need to incorporate it.
That was Teresa Murphy, Miami-Dade County Public School Teacher of the Year. You could read more about Teresa's story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. By the way, in the coming weeks, we're going to be hosting a one-hour teacher panel. We're going to be talking about the experiences of teaching during the pandemic. So teachers across South Florida, we would love to hear your story. Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Hey, maybe you could be part of that panel. And that is Sundial for this Monday, April 5th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, a focus on education. First, we're going to learn about the legislature's continued push to cut Bright Futures, the scholarship program to help high-achieving high schoolers gain access to an affordable education. A bill in the legislature could drastically change who qualifies for those funds. Plus, for-profit colleges are constantly advertised online, on television, as a quick way to get an education, but the value of those degrees and the cost is a big problem. There's an investigation in the New York Times about $30 million in student loans given to students at Florida Career College, with many of those students struggling to find jobs. And finally, hackers have targeted personal information at the University of Miami and the Broward School District. What can educational institutions do to keep their students and that information safe, considering, again, that so much learning is now being done online? All of that is coming up tomorrow on the show. Don't forget, by the way, we have a book club. We are reading Miami by Joan Didion. Just find us on Facebook, Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. And let us know what you think of the book. Again, we're reading Miami by Joan Didion. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, thank you so much for listening. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.